number of other radio stations, I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drum, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Nacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from Northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Nacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The KBOO Community Radio Artist in Residence program assists artists working creatively with sound. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KBOO mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The goals of the KBOO Artist Support Program are to support and invest in individuals who are pushing themselves artistically using sound, whose work will impact the cultural landscape of Portland, and to bring those artists into the dynamic KBOO community of local, national, and international artists and activists. Applications for the 2016 KBOO Artist in Residence are due February 12th at 5 p.m. More information and application materials are at kboo.fm/AIR2016.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is KBOO Portland.
My mother used to say, nothing for show. So what happened? I wind up in show business. Confidential magazine was coming out on a story on me when I'd been arrested, like when I was 16 or 17 years old, for being at a party that a bunch of guys were at that were dancing together. You know, you might have called it a gay party, but that word wasn't around in those days. They said we have to tab you something, so that's how tab came about. You know, I'm a firm believer that somewhere under the pile of crap, there is a pony. Go for it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucy Chappell. Marriage separates Episcopalians from the Anglican Communion, FIFA fines five countries for their homophobic fans, and Tab Hunter's pride on screen and off. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 16th, 2016. The Episcopal Church, the U.S. wing of the British-based Global Anglican Communion, remains steadfast in its support of LGBT people and marriage equality after its theological brethren punished it for sticking to those positions. In a decision that seems to have prompted the disciplinary action, the top Episcopal legislative body, called the General Convention, voted overwhelmingly last year to authorize church wedding ceremonies for lesbian and gay couples. Anglican leaders meeting this week in England stripped the Episcopal Church of any role in deciding doctrine or determining how the 85-million-member Anglican Communion operates for the next 3 years. That action essentially reduces the U.S. branch of Anglicanism to observer status. The Episcopalians ignited a rift in the Communion that's been simmering for more than a dozen years since it consecrated openly gay and partnered New Hampshire canon Gene Robinson as bishop in 2003. The theological divide pits biblical traditionalists in the global South, primarily in Africa, Asia, and South America, against more progressive branches in Europe and North America. The disciplinary decision described the U.S. Church's wholehearted embrace of LGBT members as a fundamental departure from the faith and teaching of the Anglican Church.
The Episcopal Church's presiding bishop, Michael Curry, told the Associated Press in a telephone interview on January 15th that his fellow Anglican leaders recognize that there will be no change, saying that they basically understand we made our decision and this is who we are, and we are committed to being a house of prayer for all. Archbishop of Canterbury Justin Welby, the titular leader of the Anglican Communion, had organized the gathering to help avoid a widening split in the fellowship, but he does not have the authority to force a resolution of the conflict. The Anglican Church of Canada is scheduled to vote in July on a proposal that would also allow church marriage ceremonies for same-gender couples. Canadian Archbishop Fred Hiltz, who attended the Canterbury gathering, said the penalty assessed against the Episcopalians would probably influence his church's decision. Traditionalists in the Global South were generally supportive of the sanctions against the Episcopal Church, though some complained that the punishment wasn't severe enough, and that there was no what-if discussion about what would happen at the end of the 3-year suspension. Anglicans trace their roots to the Church of England. They are the third largest grouping of Christians in the world, behind Roman Catholic and Orthodox churches. About a quarter of the Anglican Church's membership now lives in Nigeria.
Elsewhere, a Change.org petition is circulating among pro-equality Russians to protest a proposal in the nation's legislature that would criminalize coming out. Under a newly percolating bill, anyone who self-identifies as LGBT or is affectionate with a same-gender partner in public can be fined and jailed for up to 15 days. The Change.org petition, which already has more than 10,000 signatures, calls the proposed law unconstitutional, discriminatory, and anti-human. It deplores a 2013 law, strongly supported by President Vladimir Putin, that prohibits exposing minors to propaganda of non-traditional relationships, which the petition says has led to an increase in anti-LGBT aggression, including murders, and has strengthened homophobic attitudes in society. The bill's authors, Ivan Nikichuk and Nikolai Arefyev, say their proposal only targets gay men because lesbians are more reasonable and can manage their emotions. Nikichuk told the Russian news service that the so-called no-promo-homo law passed in 2013 did not go far enough. "We have our own idea of honor and conscience, and we must respect tradition," he said. "The scum that comes to us from the West is unnatural to Russia. These unconventional sexual desires do nothing but disgust normal, smart, healthy people."
Speaking of Western scum, David Mundell, Scotland's Secretary of State, became the Scottish Conservative Party's first ever openly gay cabinet minister on January 13th. He wrote on his website that coming out was the only way he could be truly happy. The 53-year-old divorced father of three, now adult children, described the conflicting emotions and internal conflicts he experienced in coming to terms with his sexuality, but said that there was an unstoppable direction of travel towards the conclusion that he's gay. Mundell has won cross-party praise for his public declaration and said that he's received love and support from his family and friends. He said he hoped people would not treat him differently now that his sexual orientation is known, and ended his website announcement by writing that gender and sexuality should make no difference whether you are a cabinet minister or in any other walk of life, and I hope that I can, in my own way, reinforce that message.
Meanwhile, a court in Lebanon has ruled that a transgender man who had undergone reassignment surgery can legally change his gender to male in the nation's civil registry. Judge Janet Hanna of the Court of Appeals of Beirut overturned a lower court decision that had denied the man's request, saying she had weighed his health and well-being in allowing the change in official records to take place. She outlined three fundamental rights in her ruling: the right to change gender to relieve psychological and social suffering, the right to access treatment for gender conditions, and the right to privacy. The judge apparently issued her ruling in September, but according to local media and LGBT activists, the decision was only made public late this week. Tarek Zaiden of Helem, a Lebanese LGBT rights group, told the Washington Blade's Michael K. Lavers that Hanna's ruling doesn't change any laws in the Middle Eastern country, but Zaiden said it was nevertheless unprecedented because it addressed the right of the person to have respect and the right to have a private life.
But two men were arrested in Morocco on January 7th after a video of them kissing went viral and prompted expressions of outrage on social media. It shows two silhouettes smooching inside the classroom of a high school. According to a local news website, the men are friends and university students, and another friend shot the video. What the North African country's penal code calls acts of sexual deviancy are punishable by a fine and up to 3 years in prison. A verdict in the swiftly prosecuted case is reportedly due at any time. Three Moroccan men each received the maximum sentence for sexual deviancy in May 2015.
In other news, FIFA has fined Argentina, Chile, Mexico, Peru, and Uruguay for homophobic chants by their national team's fans. According to a January 13th media statement by the world governing body of football, called soccer in the U.S., the insulting and discriminatory chants came during qualifying matches for the 2018 World Cup. Chile got the biggest fine, equivalent to about $70,000, over cases at four different matches. The other countries were each fined about $20,000. FIFA said that proceedings continue against Honduras for apparent homophobic chants by its supporters. The organization's disciplinary code makes any national association liable for improper conduct by its fans, including uttering insulting words. But football's governing body has admitted that financial penalties alone will not rid football of homophobia. It remains to be seen if this week's penalties put an end to the offensive chants. FIFA has already taken heat for choosing the repressive Persian Gulf nation of Qatar, which is ruled by a powerful monarchy, to host the 2022 World Cup.
Just this week, Qatar banned the multi-award-nominated movie about early 1920s trans pioneer Gili Elba. The Danish Girl, which profiles one of the first identifiable recipients of gender reassignment surgery and stars Oscar winner Eddie Redmayne, was shown in the capital city of Doha on January 14th. But further screenings were canceled as soon as government authorities issued the edict against it. According to local reports, there were several comments on social media condemning the film. One complained about its moral depravity. The country's culture ministry announced quickly in a tweet late this week that the screening of the Danish film is now banned from cinemas. We thank you for your unwavering vigilance. Homosexuality is illegal in Qatar, punished by up to 7 years in prison. Muslims can be sentenced to death. Trans people have no rights at all in Qatar.
But finally, multi-award-winning U.S. TV talk show host and proudly out and partnered lesbian Ellen DeGeneres had a special announcement this week during her weekday afternoon telecast. The hit show, which started in 2003, features a daily mix of Hollywood guests, topical comedy, and upbeat conversation. And since it's Ellen, LGBT issues are regularly part of her showbiz agenda. Ellen has already won 55 U.S. Daytime Emmys, including 9 for Outstanding Daytime Talk Show, and attracts almost 4 million viewers. And of course, since it's Ellen, her big announcement this week quickly took a comedic turn.
You know, we've been working on Get Ellie on the Telly. Today is the first day we're airing on ITV2 in Great Britain. So welcome to all my viewers across the pond, and throw another shrimp on the barbie, mate.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 16th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
This is Greg Gordon with an update to that news wrap story about a bill in Russia to outlaw coming out. Reports on January 18th suggest that the proposal has been rejected in a legislative committee. We'll have more on this developing story next week.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
It's time we get away to the movies and magic.
Our annual review of queer movies and television has morphed into a blockbuster interview double feature. So don your Hollywood shades for our multi-award-winning entertainment reporter's exclusive tour of the lot with Tab Hunter. The Psy Guy talks about his long and varied career, including a cult classic collaboration with his partner of more than 30 years, Alan Glazer.
Hello, I'm Steve Pride, and this is Pride on Screen for the year we just left behind. But rather than the usual countdown of my 10 fave flicks, this year, it's a sit-down with two fave film folk. In the first part, it was film distributor Kathy Wolf. This week, it's legendary film star Tab Hunter. One of the best documentaries of 2015 was Tab Hunter Confidential, based on Tab's memoir of the same name.
When I count three, will all of the ladies in the audience please go...
Hunter?
I
think I've died and gone to heaven.
How do you shave, Tab?
With a Gillette Super Speed, of course.
What do you like about Tab Hunter?
Well, it's quite a few things.
Don't you ever think about marrying?
All the time, Ernie. That's what keeps me single.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and I've got a secret.
My name is Tab Hunter.
I've heard of you.
I've been around a long time.
Well, let's start at the beginning because this is a big life. You had a really rough childhood.
I had a very abusive father. He was very abusive to my mother. And she left, took my brother and myself from New York to San Francisco. So we spent the first few years of our lives up in the Bay Area.
What was she like?
My mother was a really strict, religious German woman. She didn't put up with nonsense. She was a very serious person, and she kept telling us all the time, what you learn, no one can take away from you. And she pushed education, 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 because it's everything. She worked like a dog to keep us going to private schools.
Well, your mom had a saying about being showy.
My mother used to say, nothing for show. So what happened? I wind up in show business. She never liked the Hollywood hoopla. She only did one or two interviews in all the time that I was in the movies. It just wasn't her thing. She wasn't comfortable with people being in the public eye because it was too much adulation. And she said people have got to learn to divorce themselves from themselves.
I was surprised to find you were very shy.
Extremely.
How did you become an actor?
I was at a stable. I had a job out there on the weekends. I was about 14. And Dick Clayton, he was an actor, and he came out to the stable with Anne Blythe and was doing a photographic layout with her. And I used to see him out there all the time riding, and we struck up conversation, and I knew he was an actor, so I kept asking him a lot of questions. And he said, if you're really serious, you should think about doing that. And he was the one who, when I was in New York underage in the Coast Guard, he got me tickets to see my first Broadway show. He was the one who kept planting the seed all the time. You've got to work. This is not something that you fall into.
I guess your first big break was being signed with Rock Hudson's agent, Henry Wilson.
Dick Clayton introduced me to Henry Wilson, but he told me, he said, beware of Henry, because Henry's reputation is kind of strange, so I just think you should just be aware. And I was. Henry was a fairly good agent, but I left him when Dick Clayton became an agent, because he was part of my family. My mother knew him, my brother knew him, I knew him. I mean, he's a great person. And Henry was so upset by that. That Confidential magazine was coming out on a story on Rock Hudson, and he gave them a story on me when I'd been arrested, like when I was 16 or 17 years old, for being at a party that a bunch of guys were at that were dancing together. You know, you might have called it a gay party, but that word wasn't around in those days.
Henry Wilson liked to change his client's name. How did Art Galeen become Tab Hunter?
Well, they said we have to tab you something, so that's how Tab came about. And I showed horses, hunters and jumpers. So they picked Tab Hunter as opposed to Tab Jumper.
So you became Tab Hunter, and then what?
The first big film I had was an independent called Island of Desire with Linda Darnell. I did a test with Linda, and then I went off to Jamaica, and we did it in Jamaica and London, and I was terrible. I mean, really, really bad.
But you improved. Just a few years later, you beat out James Dean and Paul Newman for the lead in Battle Cry.
Merv Griffin, Marilyn Erskine and Merv and I were out having dinner one night, and Merv said, I've just read a book called Battle Cry, and I think you'd be perfect for Danny Forrester. You should have your agent check on it. So I immediately bought the book, read it, reminded me of my brother so much that I underlined everything pertaining to the character of Danny. And my agent got me an interview at Warner Brothers. I did a test, did another test, did another test. I did 9 of them. After the 8th one, they went back to New York and tested Jimmy and Paul. And then they came back and said, okay, kid, we'll give you one more chance. And I thought it was terrible, the last test, and that's the one that got me the role.
As a gay kid, my favorite Tab Hunter film on The Late Show was Damn Yankees.
Though your jaw has to go, he may come back to you again. So sleep your sleep, old girl, our love will keep, old girl, till then.
That was a fun film to do. I loved it. It was the original Broadway cast. I was the only outsider in it. And Jack Warner bought that as a gift for me, as a makeup gift, because we'd had a big argument. But I was thrilled about that because it was my first musical. And I loved that cast. I mean, how could you not love Gwen Verdon or Bobby Fosse or Gene Stapleton, Ray Walston, my gosh.
Well, if you've got to dance in a film, Bob Fosse is a pretty good guy to start with.
Well, I told Bobby, I said, I've got 2 left feet. He said, don't worry about it, you'll be fine.
You had trouble with the director, George Abbott.
He didn't want me from the start. He thought Tab Hunter's a little light in his loafers. I thought, oh, really? You know, come on, give me a break. Jack Warner said, I bought it for Tab Hunter, and Tab Hunter's going to do it, period. And you don't say no to Jack Warner.
By then, you were already a really successful recording artist. How'd that come about?
Natalie Wood and I were on promotion in Chicago for a film called The Burning Hills. It was a Louis L'Amour novel that Warner Brothers had put us in. It wasn't very good. The best thing in it was my horse. We were in Chicago, and this DJ, Howard Miller, heard me singing. And he said, did you ever think of recording? And I said, no, gosh. I used to sing in the shower a lot where everybody sounds good. Or I sang in church. And he said, would you mind if I talk to Randy Wood about you? Go in and see him. I said, sure. So Randy Wood was president of Dot Records. He called me in. He heard me sing. He presented me with a tune called Young Love. I recorded it on a Friday. Monday morning, I was driving down Sunset Boulevard. And when I heard it in the car radio, I almost hit a palm tree. I was so nervous and so excited about it. And it knocked Elvis out of the number one slot. Stayed there for about 6.5 weeks.
Young love.
And we used Elvis's backup, the Jordanaires. He wasn't happy about that. But then I've got to tell you what happened after that. We recorded an album at Dot, and then Jack Warner immediately called me into the office and said, wait a minute, what the hell do you think you're doing? I said, well, I was asked if I wanted to record, and he said, we own you for everything. I said, but Mr. Warner, you don't have a recording company. He said, well, we do now, and they started Warner Brothers Records.
You recorded a lot, though. There's a lot
I did quite there. A few albums and quite a few singles, yeah.
In the 50s, you were seen as this golden boy, but you were going through so much pain, having to hide your sexuality.
I wasn't so much hiding as running away. Whenever something was kind of scary for me, I would run out to the horses. They were my touch of reality in that unrealistic world of Hollywood. I was very, very comfortable shoveling the real stuff.
Is that basically what Hollywood is, shoveling the stuff?
Well, I think you play the game. I mean, that's your job. In those days, when you were under contract to a studio, you played whatever they wanted you to do. If they're building you into the All-American Boy, that's your job. And if you don't do the things they ask you to do, either you're on suspension from the studio. Talk to Betty Davis about that. She had 1,000 of them. Either you're under suspension, or they get rid of you and get someone else who will do what they want.
This is Steve Pride, and I'm talking to film legend Tab Hunter. Let's talk about relationships. You dated Tony Perkins.
For about 3 years, yeah. Tony was a very good actor, very bright young man, had a great sense of humor.
The pressure in any relationship is intense, but to have one where you have to keep it so secret.
Well, I've always felt that it's nobody's business.
But you still had to hide it back in the day.
I never thought about hiding it. I just kept on the go. It's hard to hit a moving object.
Your big comeback, I hate to use that word, but your big comeback in the 80s was thanks to a queer icon and his film Polyester.
John Waters called me up and he said, how would you feel about kissing a 300-pound transvestite? I said, I'm sure I've kissed a hell of a lot worse. And I'd met Divine before, who was absolutely wonderful. And having worked with Divine in Polyester, which was a great experience, it's because of that that we used him in our film, Lust in the Dust.
Which I love.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because Alan single-handedly raised all the money for that film. It was a script that I wrote. It started out as The Reverend and Rosie, and it was going to be with Cheetah Rivera and myself. And then I met Alan, and he said, I think it should be a comedy western, and you should call it Lust in the Dust. And you should use Lainey Kazan and Divine as half-sisters. And I thought, whoa, what a great idea. And he left Fox, and that was our first film together.
He rode the west. She rode the rest. Together, they ravaged the land.
God, you're disgusting.
Lust in the Dust. Coming soon from New World Pictures.
Tell me about meeting Alan, because that's a love story.
Well, he was at 20th Century Fox. I went in to do an interview with him about having worked at Fox. And I presented my script to him, and he read it and got back to me and said that he thought it was a really good idea. He presented it to Fox, but they passed on it. And then we spoke about that, and he said, I'll leave Fox. I'll find a way of making this happen. He's a very good producer.
When did you know he was the one?
The one. I just never thought of it that way. I just thought, that kid is really sharp. I really like him. He's a decent human being.
You seem to be a very happy person.
You know, I'm a firm believer that somewhere under the pile of crap, there is a pony. Go for it.
Do you think your looks hurt you being taken seriously as an actor?
Probably, but people always put emphasis on the wrong thing. What you are as a person inside and how you think, those are important things. The rest of it is a bunch of garbage.
You're Catholic, correct?
Oh, yeah.
But you had a bad experience coming clean to a priest in confession at one point.
Well, that was many, many years ago. Recently, we had a screening of our film in Connecticut, and only a few miles from the theater was my good friend Dolores Hart. She was an actress, but now she's a mother superior at the Abbey of Regina Laudis there. So I emailed the mother, Dolores, and I said, I'd love for you to come to our screening. And she came to it. And Rex Reed and I were up on stage doing a little Q&A afterwards. And he introduced Mother Dolores. She stood up and took a bow. And then, like the flying nun, came down the aisle to the footlights, you know, the front of the stage. And I jumped off the stage to stand by her because I really love her and I've known her a long time. Then she looked right out of the audience, and I love what she said. I want to tell you all, there is no hetero, there is no homo, there is only love. And I thought, whoa! She's pretty fantastic.
I know Dolores Hart from King Creole with Elvis and Where the Boys Are. Did you ever do a film with her?
She actually did The Pleasure of His Company on Broadway with Cyril Richard. And when I was signed to do the movie, I was sure that it was going to be Dolores Hart, but they gave it to Debbie Reynolds. Of course, I'd known Debbie forever, you know, because we grew up together.
You were on a lot of studio arranged dates and things with Debbie
Reynolds. I wouldn't call those studio arranged dates. The studio wants someone to go to an opening, you go. And why not go with somebody you know really well and enjoy being with rather than some pretty thing that's boring? Debbie's a hell of a lot of fun. Always has been. And since she blew the French horn in the band at Burbank High School.
And Natalie Wood?
Nat was like my kid sister. She was much younger than me. And I really think she's just a delightful, charming gal. And of course, I was so thrilled that we were able to get Bob Wagner in our documentary because RJ is, without a doubt, the most level-headed person you'll ever meet. And he never talks about Natalie. And it was wonderful for him talking there about our relationship and all that because the press has been so despicable about Natalie's death. But then the press has a tendency to be like that.
Here you are with your dogs and your husband and your ranch and... What's the biggest misconception about Tab Hunter or Art Galeen?
I don't know.
Do you care?
No.
This has been a conversation with Tab Hunter and the conclusion of Pride on Screen 2015. Tab's memoir and the documentary about his life are both entitled Tab Hunter Confidential. This is Deep Pride. Thanks for listening.
They say for every boy and girl there's just one love in this whole world, and I know I found mine.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Christopher Gall, Michael LeBeau, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Brian Wilson with Van Dyke Parks and Tab Hunter performed some of the music you heard. And Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucy Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KOPN Columbia, Missouri, WUML Lowell, Massachusetts, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.
Welcome back, listeners. How are you? Doc, let's hop right into hot topics. Something that caught my eye this week. Have you ever seen the movie The Hunger Games?
Yes.
Okay, so you know that series. You're familiar with some of the characters, at least.
Yes.
Rue.
Yeah.
Rue, and folks will remember Rue, I think, because...
There was so much... Well, she played Rue in The Hunger Games, and there was so much controversy around, even though in the book itself, she's clearly black, and she's clearly a young black girl... I guess most of the readers of The Hunger Games, they read her as white because of, I guess, her innocence, her age, all this kind of stuff they kind of projected onto the character. So when the film comes out, everybody's like so mad and up in arms that Rue is played by a black girl, you know, so yes.
And then she also has made headlines recently as an activist because she is all about black girl empowerment and things of that nature. So she actually has made headlines again because she has recently come out of the closet as being bisexual. She was interviewed by Solange Knowles, who is Beyonce's little sister, for Teen Vogue magazine. And they essentially talked about how important it was, and she thanked the magazine for putting people like her on the cover, for including diverse representations of what it means to be a black girl or a black woman. And she mentioned some folks that she really appreciates, like Solange Knowles and Willow Smith. But she talked a bit about what it means to try to find your identity and try to fit yourselves into molds and shapes that people tell you that you should be in. And so she revealed that she says, quote, "As someone who identifies as a black bisexual woman, I've been through it." That is, being through trying to fit into spaces in which you don't necessarily fit. So, you know, for me, I think it's always cool we can add another person to our list.
Yes.
Right, to the Rainbow family.
Especially to the B list, because I just feel like, you know, in terms of bisexuality, I think that there isn't really a lot of bi visibility out there. And I don't really find, especially celebrities or really famous people.
And then even more so among people of color. Like, even like, I mean, we think of, for example, I mean, Anne Heche, who I think she identified as a lesbian for a little while, but even in terms of bisexual, we think of Anne Heche. Andy Dick, you know, when we think
does
of white,
Andy Dick identify as bi?
Andy Dick, we think of white people. Like, very rarely do you think of a black person in Hollywood.
Because Miss Kiki Palmer just came out, but she came out as sexually fluid.
Which is different as well. But there is power in claiming the word bisexual.
Definitely,
you know, to come from a young woman of color, I think was awesome. So. You wanted to talk a bit about Taraji?
Yes, Taraji won a Golden Globe last night for Best Actress in a Dramatic Series. Yeah. And as she was like going to receive her award, she like has this handful of cookies at her table and she's like passing them out to people.
And I pointed out that she wasn't wearing any gloves.
Yeah,
and
no.
It's like, that's not sanitary. But you know, I work in the food service industry, so I'm like, oh my gosh, she doesn't have any gloves. It's not a box. Like,
yeah.
It's OSHA or
But you know, for her, it's like tongue in cheek because she won for her role as Cookie, that people are constantly making memes of Cookie. They're constantly quoting Cookie.
She is a pop culture icon at this point. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you, Doc, because you and I have talked a bit about my feelings about her character. But right now, she has her show. Then you have How to Get Away with Murder, starring
Viola Davis.
Viola Davis. And initially, Viola was getting like awards. Remember, like she won, but now it seems like it's more Taraji. Who do you think is the better, and I've asked this on Facebook, like who do you think is the better actress, or can you compare them in terms of their roles that they're in now? Not like all their whole body of work, but I think that what she does.
Well, I feel like you prefer aspects of How to Get Away with Murder more so than aspects of Cookie's character on Empire. Like, although you love Empire for its LGBT visibility, especially with Jamal's character, how black people have dealt with the different nuances of homophobia. Like, we're not going to necessarily reject you outright, but we're still going to have these like little comments and these kind of unaccepting ways, you know, while you stay in your family and you appreciate it for that. You kind of feel like Cookie's character isn't really that complicated.
Yeah, it's not very complicated. And the entire show to me is not a very complicated show even. It's very, even like really kind of really cheesy, borderline cheesy, versus How to Get Away with Murder. Shonda Rhimes, everything she writes, although it's melodramatic, I mean, it's really well written. Like, these are for real interesting storylines and they take nuanced characters.
Well, I do think that Viola Davis's character just has more range when it comes to the emotions she's supposed to display. Like,
Cookie because of the ratchet? Like, you know, in terms of it, she kind of hints at this in her acceptance speech.
Yeah.
She said, yo, I thought I would have gotten an award for Benjamin Button or for these other roles, you know, but I'm now getting awarded for playing a woman who spent 17 years in prison for selling crack.
Yeah, basically, I mean, that character is much more relatable to, I think, the American public versus a character like Viola Davis, who, one, was in a, you know, her character is married to a white man who her cohort ends up murdering. She's also a high-profile criminal, defense lawyer who's extremely sophisticated, well-educated, well-traveled, obviously, and a lot of Americans aren't able to relate to that type of character.
Relate to that, or that they don't want to? Do you understand what I mean? Like, in terms of relating, it means that you can see that as authentic. Maybe they don't want that kind of a character. They don't want that. Just like Halle Berry, how she won her award for playing a certain kind of role, Denzel playing a certain kind of role, despite much better acting in other movies, people want the ratchet Cookie. They want to elevate that over Viola's
character.
Oh,
so you're saying like Denzel winning for Training Day versus not winning for Malcolm X.
Yes.
Or Halle Berry not winning for Losing Isaiah, but winning for,
that ratchet addict who was like sleep with Billy Bob Thornton and stuff.
Yeah,
and
the problem is she wasn't even an addict in that film.
Oh, she wasn't?
No. You just read her as such.
Okay,
but,
y'all like,
because of the
best.
Thirst and desperation for Billy Bob's character. And he's
But like, do you think those things are accidental, or do you think those things are intentional?
I don't know. I mean, with Cookie's character, in as much as she placates to a certain stereotypical vision of black urban womanhood, I also think that there are different nuances to her character, like her unapologetic accepting, you know, her acceptance of her gay son.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that counters Lucius and the husband's kind of like, oh yeah, you can't be gay, I ain't supporting this. You know, so like typically a ratchet character as Cookie wouldn't have all of the sophistication around queer identity how natural it is for her to accept Jamal, how she kind of, you know, tries to throw shade at his little boyfriend because no one's good enough for her son. I mean, she's very, so she has certain nuances about herself that are outside of a stereotypical view of urban black womanhood, I think, right? But there is something to be said for the fact that a lot of black actors and actresses typically are only recognized when they play stereotypical roles. Yeah. Like Denzel in Training Day is kind of the black brute, or this kind of evil black dude. Yeah. And then you have Halle Berry, who is obviously playing a type of Jezebel role, which is a controlling image for black women,
you have
who
the
is
help,
highly sexed.
The help.
Yeah, the help, which is the kind of mammified perception of black women. Because what's the name one for the help? The one who made
Octavia
the,
Spencer, right?
Yeah, Octavia, yes, yeah. Who made the poop pie. Like, the poop pie. And, you know, and everybody lived for that part and stuff like that. So there is something to be said that when black actors and actresses tend to be recognized, they are getting recognized for roles that are basically old stereotypes in black, in major film, in the Oscars, everything. Yeah. So I'm not sure.
Like, oh boy, didn't even get nominated for the movie Creed. Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah.
He didn't even get nominated for his role in that movie. But Sylvester Stallone did.
Oh, I know. And then what was so funny is when Sly Stallone, when he gets up there to do the thanking, don't thank the black director or his black castmates. So he doesn't even mention it. And it is. It's kind of this revamping. I mean, it's like, when's the last time Sylvester Stallone was in any film?
Yeah.
So he kind of really should have given.
He like did a film like Arnold Schwarzenegger or something. It was like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like Steven Seagal. It's like, these are really back in the day actors. And
this is true.
You know, so you should really be thanking your lucky stars, honey.
Speaking of back in the day, Doc, someone famous died this week.
Yeah.
He's been around since back in the day.
Yeah.
Made you really sad.
It made me very sad.
David Bowie.
Yeah.
Tell us, why you like him so much?
Well, I love Bowie just because of his androgyny, his gender nonconformity. I love that Bowie seemed to be his authentic self at a time where we didn't even know the term authentic self. I mean, he was doing what he wanted to do, how he wanted to do it in terms of his aesthetic, his dress, his music.
How did he dress for people who don't know? What
I mean,
what,
it was kind
was
of
look?
Like a, to me, it was like either like a gender queer, you know.
Like makeup or like
he would
mascara.
Wear like lipstick and stuff. And even though we had rock stars like Kiss and what's his name? Alison Change. They would wear makeup and they would have their hair long and stuff like that. But Bowie did it in a way that he really was attempting to expand how we understand gender, how we understand gender expression. And then, of course, I've always loved his love affair with Iman. I mean, the show Scandal that puts Fitz and Olivia Pope, this black woman and white man together. I mean, even now people are like, oh my God, can you believe this interracial relationship between a white man and a black woman? And Bowie was doing it, I mean, way, way, way before that. I mean, him and Iman have been married and in love for years. They're known for their intense love affair, their children. He was always kind of saying how beautiful she was, and not about it wasn't didn't seem to be couched in exoticism or this kind of like racial projection so much as he just loved her and felt like she was a beautiful woman. And I really loved watching their love affair over the years and their children. And it's sad. I'm heartbroken for Iman. I don't know what it would feel like to lose
a partner,
that kind of love. Yeah. And I mean, we should all be so lucky to experience that kind of sure love.
Yeah.
They seem to be surely in love, and there was no question in it. And I mean, Bowie went on Soul Train before any kind of white musician. I mean, Bowie's love for black people and black culture didn't seem to be this put on. It wasn't about being chic. It wasn't about being cutting edge. It was something that was very natural. He was great. He was great. And it's going to be, I mean, even space. Like, I was looking on Tumblr because I was like crying about David Bowie. Like, I was looking on Tumblr and Kevin Spacey said, "The stars will sure look different tonight." I'm heartbroken. You know, everybody seems to be, you know, it's just.
Oh, don't cry.
I mean, you know, and it seems weird, you know, but I just felt like he was like a friend in my head, and so was Iman. Yeah. And like, they were my friends. Yeah. And when I was a young person.
At first, it sounded weird to me, but then I thought about it, and I'm like, I felt that way about Princess Diana. Like, I cried when she died. So now I know what it is. I'm like, why are people tripping over these celebrities? But now I realize, like, there are things about their lives you identify with.
And when I was a kid, I was always about being true to myself. I was always about promoting myself, no matter what society thought about blackness or femaleness or gayness. And I feel like Bowie was the same way. He challenged white America. He challenged us.
Yeah.
And he was a great dude. He just seemed like a nice person. And You know, I'm just embarrassing. I'm like crying about it.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what. Rest in peace, David Bowie. Let's take a break. Let you clear yourself up, y'all. When we come back, we're going to talk to Francine Russo. Doc, as you know, Francine Russo has written a very interesting article for the Scientific American Mind about transgender young people, what helps them thrive, especially medically, when it comes to introducing hormone treatment and all those kind of things. She's helping us make sense of how to best help trans young people. So this is Strange Fruit on WFPL. Are you hungry for more Strange Fruit?
I'm hungry.
Just can't wait for more?
Where else can you go in, get it done your way, and go out without paying?
Visit us online at strangefruitpod.org.
Like us on Facebook.
You like the adulation, the applause.
Or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
And this is what the gay life is about.
Thanks for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit on WFPL.
So listeners, we're lucky enough to live in a time where more and more parents of trans children are accepting, they're loving, and they're trying to help their kids be their authentic selves. The medical community is developing new ways for trans kids to achieve their body goals, but experts disagree on what those treatments should be. That's the subject of an article in this month's issue of the Scientific American Mind. And the author of that article, Francine Russo, is here with us today to talk about it. Francine, thanks for being with us.
It is my pleasure.
Tell our listeners, how is gender dysphoria diagnosed in young people and children?
Usually it comes from the children. They, the ones who are most clearly trans, are saying from the time they can speak, I'm a girl, mommy. Stop calling me a boy. I'm a girl. Or the reverse. And they do not participate in the gender appropriate, what their parents think are the gender appropriate behaviors. And so the parents, having been educated by the media lately and in schools, in some schools in fairly liberal places, the parents have begun to take their children to some of the new gender clinics that are located at universities in major cities around the country and say, is my kid trans? And, you know, they definitely cannot get a definite answer when the children are below, say, 12 before puberty, but they can get an idea of the probability.
So let's ask this. So you have a child that has gone through testing and they and their doctors have decided to go ahead with treatment. What are some of the treatment options that are available to young people?
Well, the treatment options themselves, they're only available once the child has begun puberty. Let's be clear, no children, actual children below the age of puberty get any kind of treatment. Doctors wait till the very first sign of puberty. And then, as you say, if they've been through the battery of psychological tests and their gender history, et cetera, then the question is what to do for them first. What most doctors and the endocrine society, the professional standards say, is you give kids at the first sign of puberty hormones which are puberty blockers. They will halt their sexual development right there. And they will stay that way until they reach 14, 15, 16. And that's where the controversy in the field is. Some doctors feel if the child is so clearly trans and has been for a very, very long time, what they say in the field is the child has been insistent, persistent, and consistent over time, those children, some doctors feel, should get cross-sex hormones and start going through puberty as early as 14 or 15, although the professional standards say don't do it before 16.
Yeah.
And why do they say that? Why do they say that you should wait until the age of 16 or puberty? Like one doctor you spoke with in the article referred to puberty as one's true test of gender.
Right. Well, the thing is that there have been a lot of studies done in mostly in Amsterdam. The Dutch have been doing this a much longer time. And they've studied children who come into their gender clinic from the time they're, say, 5 or 6 or 7 years old, and they've studied them until the age of 16. And it turns out that even though many of these children and their parents also seem to think that they are transgender or have gender dysphoria, after they reach puberty, by 16, the majority of these kids will no longer be presenting as transgender. Because when they start to experience puberty, both the physical signs of their body changing, the social milieu that changes around them, you know, boys hang out with boys and girls with these kids who have been, you know, girls playing with trucks or boys interested playing with makeup, these kids change and they often accept the body that they get at puberty. Most of them do. So it's very, very hard to predict until puberty which kids will actually remain transgender.
So even though hormone therapy is not recommended until the teenage years, there are parents, though, that help their kids make what's called a social transition before they get perhaps on hormone therapy. What does it mean to make a social transition, and then does an early social transition affect a child's eventual outcome?
Well, that is a very good question. Well, thank you. A social, especially about the outcome, a social transition is a child, maybe a child as young as five, who's been saying, I am a boy mommy from the time they're 2 and a half, that child wants to go to school wearing boy's clothes, a boy's haircut, to be called he and him, referred to, and to have a boy's name. And if the parent allows the child or helps the child to do that, to go to school as the gender they feel they are, that is called a social transition. Okay. There is no medical change, but the child who appears to be a biological girl is now called Justin and is wearing a boy's haircut and is wearing boy's clothes and goes to the boys' bathroom if that school is liberal enough, or a gender-neutral bathroom if they have one. And the teachers are alerted, the kids are alerted that this is now Justin. Or maybe that, you know, and Justin is a he and referred to as he and him. So that is a social transition. And kids, and it can be done at any age. I believe there are some adults who just do a social transition and don't do any medical transition.
So in terms of treatment for individuals at any age, they seem to be costly and are typically not covered by insurance. So the kids we're talking about receiving treatment are probably from higher socioeconomical levels, right? Are there any alternative treatments that are less expensive, for instance? Are they safe? Do we know anything about the outcomes for less wealthy trans kids?
And especially because I lived on in the East Coast for a while, and or we take the movie, for example, Paris is Burning, a lot of black and brown trans women in particular in urban areas will buy their hormones on the black market or go to a silicone doctor in a back room somewhere. So they do try to access medical care and cosmetic care on the black market. So how does that work for young people? Is it similar as it is for like trans teenagers and trans adults in terms of how they can transition if their insurance doesn't cover it?
Well, cross-sex hormones like testosterone or estrogen are far cheaper than puberty blockers.
Okay.
The real issue for many of these kids is that puberty blockers cost a fortune, and some insurance companies are starting to cover it, but many do not. And so some doctors are saying, okay, you can't afford puberty blockers. I will give you cross-sex hormones, which are much cheaper, earlier.
So you met and interviewed several trans kids and their families in the course of you writing this article. What are some of the things that stick out to you about their individual stories?
The first thing that really made me understand what it felt like to be trans is hearing the stories from parents and from kids who are, you know, kids who are now teens, but the stories from parents of children who are 3 and 4 insisting, knowing their gender as soon as they could talk, and feeling like there was one incredibly really, some of these stories are heartbreaking, where a little boy, he was three, and he said to his mother, "Mommy, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy. Something went wrong when I came out of your tummy. Put me back so I can come out as, you know, as a girl." And she, you know, the mother was just, like, disbelieving, and but this child was utterly miserable. And for the parent, it's incredibly wrenching, because a mother or a father has a different relationship with the son than they have with the daughter.
Certainly.
And so it's very hard to just say, okay, now you're a girl, or okay, now you're a boy. And that for the parents, they, even if they accept, once they accept that their child is trans, they have to grieve for the daughter they're losing before they can accept and love the son that they now
Certainly,
have.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
Yeah. Yeah. In your article, you refer to the Netherlands as a place, as an example of a place, rather, that successfully supports trans citizens. Talk to us a bit about the Netherlands. How do they deal with trans issues in that country, and what kinds of outcomes are they seeing there?
Well, there is one major transgender clinic in Amsterdam. It's not a, you know, it's not a huge country, so everybody who wants to go can get treatment in Amsterdam, and the government pretty much picks up the tab.
Okay.
So money is not an issue. Also, it's a very accepting society. So some of the, you know, the very first transgender people and transgender surgeries on adults were done in Scandinavia and in the Netherlands. So it's a far more, there's far less stigma, and if parents can bring the kids in early when they're still children or just starting puberty, the children can actually go through puberty in what they call their experience gender. If they have the body of a girl but they feel they are a boy, well, they don't have to go through, you know, they don't, this person who feels he's a boy doesn't have to get a period, doesn't have to get breasts, or, you know, can actually go through a pretty normal teenage boyhood.
Yeah.
and look like a boy and like a man.
Yeah.
Without having to do, you know, and never have, you know, and a girl would never have to shave or, you know, have a voice that doesn't match. These people, you know, caught early and treated early, these kids can blossom into the gender that they feel, which is
Certainly.
An amazing thing.
Yeah. Before we let you go, there's a sidebar in your article that talks a bit about an imaging study, or imaging studies rather, of trans folks' brains. Talk to us a bit about those two different studies and what they have revealed. Like, I think there was a quote that says that trans people have brains that are different from males and females, a unique kind of brain. Talk to us more about that, please.
Well, males and females in general have slight structural differences in their brains. So, now this is on average, so that it's not possible for a brain scientist to do an MRI, you know, to look at a brain and tell you for 100% for sure whether it's male or female.
Okay.
But they can tell you it's probably male or it's probably female. Now, with trans people, what they've been doing is taking MRIs of obviously living people before they have hormone treatment and after. And they are finding that, in general, the people who are trans tend to have brains somewhat more similar to the gender that they feel they are rather than the gender they look like to others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not definitive, but it's a strong indication that there are biological differences. And so what the scientists are saying are these people have brains that are neither male nor female. They have a transgender brain, but it's a little more similar to their experience gender than to what they call their assigned gender, what they were assigned by their biology.
I tell you what, Francie, this has been extremely interesting to me. One of my favorite new reality television shows is called I Am Jazz, about the young lady Jazz Jennings, who is a trans young person. She, on the show, documents going to the doctor. They discuss puberty blockers. They discuss her desire to kind of amp up her hormone treatments. And so it's been really fascinating to then be able to pair your article with what I've seen there on the television show and help me make more sense of it. So I really appreciate your article. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was such an interesting article.
That was a very interesting article.
Yes.
And we talked about some good stuff during the Hot Topics until you started crying. But I understand. But I do understand, though, because
yeah.
during the commercial break, you explained more a bit about like why, just what his death brought up in your own head about what it means to love somebody for a long time and then for them to be with them every day. Like, literally wake up beside them, cook them dinner at night. Like, you know, then like they're just not there ever again anymore.
I just don't,
you know,
I just don't.
That
makes
you sad.
And that kind of love, too. I mean, it's not just about, like, that kind of intimate partnership love, but it's also, like, friendship love.
Yeah.
Like, if anything ever happened to you.
Oh.
Or, if anything ever happened to Little. Or, people I've loved, would I cry? Oh, come
on. I don't know. Like, have you wondered? You know,
I mean,
like,
it would destroy me.
Do you ever think about, like
I just,
like,
I can't conceive of... Somebody and maybe because I'm still young. I mean, even though I just turned 36.
Yeah.
Oops. I mean, I still feel young at heart.
And I'm still 35.
And, like, my grandma, for instance, like, everyone she's ever loved in her life is gone.
Like, I was like, do you think as one gets older, is one more resigned to the idea that people are going to die? Like, do you think that do you think old people still cry every time they lose a friend? Or they just sort of
that's what I'm saying. Mo is so stoic about it. She goes, I know it's your birthday, but... You know, I just heard from my cousin that my other cousin passed, and, Lucia, and I'm like, oh, my God, and then she's like, oh, yeah, but everybody's gone, baby. Yeah. And I'm like, but still, like, I just can't fathom having that kind of, and I mean, Mo is 86 and I'm 36, but I mean, that kind of death is so permanent and
it
so...
is.
Final. So to me, it's too much.
It is. And if one believes that this is all that there is, but a lot of people believe that there's something more.
Yeah.
So in some cases, it probably isn't as final as we think it is, but that's
let's hope.
Yeah. But that's not this kind of show. This is not a religious show.
Get it together.
We are out of time.
Okay.
We will come back next week and do this all over again and have lots of fun.
We
promise. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Strange Fruit is produced by 89.3 WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Our producer is Laura Ellis.
For more information on Strange Fruit, go to strangefruitpod.org. Find us on Facebook or visit us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views presented on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
I'm Jason Gardner.
And I'm Kyla Story.
Thanks for listening.
This is Mike Crenshaw.
And Monica Beamer.
We're your Cable Station co-managers. We wanted to say thank you to all of our members for helping Cable to exceed our goals in December. We appreciate everyone's generosity and commitment to Cable, and we can't do all that we do with